Okay, so it is 7:05. So I better start talking so I can stop talking at 8:30. Well, thank you guys for coming. It is week four, halfway. Well, we will be halfway if we survive the night. It just, the image, I was marveling at, what a great innovation, and then it just sort of struck me as an analogy for what we're doing here. So, you know, there's a lot of different emergencies that happen because of fires. You know, it could be all different contexts, right? A kitchen, a forest. And the common thing in all the situations, right, if you're the person engaging the fire, is one, I want to put the fire out, and two, I want to help people and keep people safe. And in this case, we just have a different method that will work in certain situations. And really, there's no difference in what it's meant to do, right? You want to put out the fire, and there's no different in what's, in a lot of ways, the composition isn't even different. It's the same formula, just in a different delivery system. But, so that's the key difference, right? It's just a different delivery method. And I thought, well, that's kind of poignant. That's kind of what we're doing. We're looking for a certain method for moving people in their own minds closer to Christ, even if it's just, you know, one step. And all of us, you know, us here, people in churches, people in ministries, that's the ultimate thing. We have a core ultimate thing, right? To move people to be disciples of Christ. And so we have sometimes a different way of engaging, a different delivery method, same as the fireball or the fire extinguishing ball. So different things for different contexts, right? And especially the context for us here is finding out where something is in their heart and in their mind. And that's our context of engaging them. So I found that really encouraging to realize, and by analogy, you know, the core thing is still the same. We want to create disciples. It's just that we want to strive to use the best possible engagement tactics that we can, given the context. Right? Does anybody have a Bible? No. I'll read it. I was going to ask somebody to look it up, but I don't. So I was reminded of Paul saying, talking about being all things to all people. Right? And I thought, well, that's what I want to be. And then I reread his little passage there, and it's really, really good. This is 1 Corinthians 9:19-20. Just want to sort of massage our hearts here for a moment before we talk tactics. He says, though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. And to those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. And to those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law. So as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. I just thought that was profound. Think about one, it's motivating because it motivates us to not be comfortable with or complacent about how we might engage people. And two, it promotes the idea that there's a variety of ways of engaging people, and this is one that we don't want to miss out on because of our, if we go back in the slides to, you know, some of our context, the culture, the way it is, we don't want to miss out on ministering effectively to those people. All right, so We may come back to this slide again as fuel for, you know, maybe doing some role play, but I'll come back to that. And I'll dive right into our next tactic. This one's called taking the roof off.
But I think that's a brilliant lyric that you may say, I'm a dreamer, John Lennon song, but I'm not the only one. That's pretty profound because it's kind of like a story of everybody has, there's a lot of people out there that want to have hope, and hope might seem like a dream because there'll never no longer be peace on this earth. But it's just a profound lyric that was in, within that song.
Right. Like even though the conclusion may be different, he's identifying the human condition.
Exactly.
That we all are hoping for something.
Yeah. I can't remember the lyrics before and after, but or the context in which you wrote it.
Yeah, I'd have to look up the whole song, but
yeah.
Good observation, yes. Okay, so what is taking the roof off? Well, and just a reminder, I mean, what these are, I mean, what we're doing is we're looking at basically ways that logic works and how we can identify sort of missteps in people's thinking so that we can graciously ask them to work that out and hopefully put a rock in their shoe to think about it more when they see that it doesn't fly. So taking the roof off, well, let's think about that as an image. You can picture if somebody has a view or makes a statement, that's the roof. You know, that's sort of the capstone. It's the thing that's exposed that you're looking down at. And if you really want to see the foundations or the implications or the inner workings of the view, you take the roof off and kind of rummage around inside the house and see what's inside, right? That's the image. And I know I've probably said this more than enough times, but I think it's key that there are a lot of people who sort of treat what they believe or what they say or what they, when you interact with them, what comes across is something they're sort of parroting something they picked up somewhere, and they just stick with that and they don't go any deeper than that. So that's sort of like this whole same idea of a bumper sticker, or it's just the roof, and they never take the roof off and look inside the structure and see what's going on. They just think the roof is enough. So what we're trying to do is take the roof off and sort of graciously force the issue for them to think through what they're promoting or abiding by. And I've added this picture of the blindfold being cut off because I think it's just a helpful reminder. It's very easy to go through logic, especially for me, get all excited about, I really like studying logic and thinking about this. And then it can be very easy to lose sight of what the real goal is. It's a person, it's a soul. So I think a blindfolded person is a helpful image for me because even though we're going to study the inner workings of a logical view, at the end of the day, what is helpful is that we're removing an obstacle for the person. So I think of it as removing a blindfold. I mean, if there is, going back a little bit, there is a spiritual reality, right? I mean, this is ultimately, there's something happening underneath and behind the scenes. And there are a variety of ways that the spiritual enemy would like to muddy the waters or steer people in the wrong direction. And for me, I've been on quite a few missions trips where I go to another nation or another situation, and it seems really clear. Man, these people are worshiping idols or doing this or that, and it's so apparent. But here, in our culture, it's much more subtle, especially for us as insiders. We don't notice it really as much. That reasoning and false reasoning can be one of the obstacles that's actually spiritually sourced, as it were. So, anyways, I like the image of the blindfold because it constantly reminds me that I'm trying to help a person rather than just do straight up logic for logic's So I've mentioned this term before, reductio ad absurdum, but that's sort of the formal logical thing at play here. And really that's just Latin for reducing to absurdity. The idea being that somebody makes a statement and we notice that it has more to it than what they realize, and we're trying to help them rethink what they're promoting based on some absurdity that we could show that would result if their view is true. And I've listed a couple other ways of thinking about this. Another way would be, it's a view that proves too much. So if the view is true, then other unacceptable things are true. In other words, they have an intended conclusion they want, but they don't may not realize that there are other conclusions that are also true that they would not like to have true, or they would not accept as true rationally as well. So for instance, here I'll give an example of moral relativism. I know I use that example a lot, but it's sort of low-hanging fruit sometimes. So one value that a moral relativist wants to establish is that people should have liberty to follow their own beliefs or conclusions. But the actual statement of moral relativism is something like, what is true for you is true for you. And it's really true. It's not just sort of true for you. If you believe it's true, for you it's true. And for me it's the same. So that's the conclusion that they think is carrying weight for them. But here's an initial conclusion, and this is the example I always use because it's so morally repugnant for me to think about. It proves also that it's okay to beat homosexuals to death for their perceived self-identity as long as that is the ethic for that person committing the violence, or perhaps for their culture, within their culture it's okay. So if their initial statement, if their intended conclusion that truth is relative to the person or the community is true, they'd have to also admit that's other conclusion. Now, if you push that issue, they're either going to have to say, yes, I guess I do, and sort of deny their moral perception that should be true in any culture, as something that's okay, or they're going to be stuck in tension between the two, which is sort of the next point of tension. One of the ideas is to bring a person to a point of tension, like I just did in that example. And the point of tension is, well, I got to pick. It's sort of like you have to pick one or the other. Either stick with the view or question the view because there's something unlivable about it. Francis Schaeffer has a good basic quote on this. He says, and that's his sort of terminology, point of tension. He says, no non-Christian can be consistent to the logic of his presuppositions.
Wow, that's pretty good.
That's a profound one, yeah.
What year was that, may I ask?
That book is, I don't know, I think that book's in the 70s.
Yeah.
Schaeffer engaged in what he called cultural apologetics, which is sort of right along the lines of this whole step. Is he talked about the unlivability of things like atheism or relativism or other things, because the person, imagine a two-story house, and on the bottom level is sort of naturalism and naturalistic ways of explaining things like morality or existence. let's take morality, for instance. It's one thing to operate in the first level and try to keep it all within the paradigm of naturalism, but what happens in your actual life when you're living in the real world? What happens is they sneak up to the second story, which is transcendent things like objective morality and things like that, and then go borrow that in their real life, how they actually live. So he's pushing the issue of bringing to a point of attention to say, well, which is it? Are you admitting the second story or not? So can you live consistently with your worldview, is his point. And one more way of thinking of it is, exposing denial, or drawing out the implications of a view that are ignored. Now, just a caveat, what I'm not trying to say here is that everybody that disagrees with me about whether morality is relative or not is just in denial. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that is a common thing that happens. And when we identify that, that's helpful. There are other times where you will run into somebody or engage with somebody that is well read, as it were, right? They've actually thought through some of these more foundational issues. And what that does is it pushes the question of what's wrong in the thinking to a deeper, more foundational level than someone else within the argument. But what I'm talking about here is people, it could be that it's somebody that simply hasn't thought deeply or carefully about that roof, that bumper sticker, that slogan. That's as far as they've gotten. So I would say they can either be ignorant of the deeper workings of the view, or they can be willfully ignorant, as it were, which would be denial. Because they know better about how they interact with reality in the real life, that second story of shape I was talking about, where they act as though those things are true, yet in their statement, they try to deny those very things that they live by. So that's all, I guess, abstract and theoretical, what I'm saying. But what about the tactic? What does it look like? What are we doing when we use this tactic? Well, it's basically three steps. Identify the basic argument, test drive it, and point out the implications. So identifying the basic argument, well, two things I want to say about this. One is a reminder that what we tend to do, especially Christians, but I think this is just human nature, is we think about a lot of things, and then it's an interesting or compelling topic, and when we start to engage somebody, suddenly we want to spill the beans completely. Like, I have 40 things I'm going to say about this and present to you the whole worldview and why this is the right worldview. Well, that's just not very effective. What is effective, in my opinion, and in the opinion of people who write books like this, like Greg Kokel, is to work on one thing. And this is actually something we do in philosophy, right? When you read a philosophy paper, it's very precise and narrow in its claim because you can't get down to any precision or make much progress if you're trying to talk about everything, especially in conversation. You probably have this kind of conversation where you have an interesting dialogue going and it's 2 hours later and you've covered everything from A to Z. But nobody's moved in any direction on the views. All you did is both recite your world views, and there was no movement. I think there's more of a chance for movement if you sort of identify one thing and just engage on that one thing and try to pinpoint a point of tension that there is in the view. So that first step, identify the basic argument, is important because if you want to do something manageable like that, then you've got to have something that can basically be identified in a sentence or said in one breath. That is the point of issue. Otherwise, it's just too difficult to talk about a whole bunch at the same time. So the next thing is to test drive it. So you're sort of playing, you're asking, okay, inside your head, you're asking, if I was to advocate this view, what does that mean? What are the implications of that? And then taking that and handing it back to them in the form of a question. So you're identifying the view. I think what you're saying is that morality is based on subjective feelings or opinions about that, either individually or in cultures. And then the test drive would be, now if that's true, isn't it also true that, or wouldn't that also imply that, pick your statement there. So what you're doing is you're giving the question back to them to let them see the implication. And so pointing out the implication could be the process that happens after you've asked that question and you continue to interact. You point out, if they don't see it, you might have to point it out. Or if they see it, then you can bring it back around, right? And point out, well, doesn't that make you question your initial statement? Yes, go ahead.
Example, what if someone says, well, I live and let live? That's the simple, but anyway, in the last 50 years, I live and let live. And then the other person might say, well, if you are then, if you believe at all, I don't know, I'm just going to, okay, if you are pro-life, then you think it's okay for somebody to kill somebody at a clinic just because you might think that you might save a life that way by injuring someone else. You live and let live. You're allowing something to happen that goes against what you let's say you're pro-life, but you live and let live. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. So if you're pro-life, you're pro-preserving a life to kill another life. You see what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
But it's also interesting, the high correlation between pro-life views and pro-war views. Because it makes a difference what you're fighting about. Mm-hmm. But still, the idea of, I'm still puzzling, I'm trying to remember the context of Schaeffer's report. Because I'm inclined to wonder if Christians can be consistent with the logic of our presuppositions. If the nature of God really is something that we have come into terms with, then is our behavior really constructed in a manner consistent with that particular aspect of what is believed or what is taken to be true?
Right.
And it's a little bit like, as I was thinking about it, perhaps, we used to talk about a thing called practical atheism. A person might say, yes, I believe there's a God, but they live as if there were a God.
Mm-hmm.
There's no accountability.
Sure, yeah.
There's no sense of obligation to do particular things consistent with the nature of the God that confirms. And perhaps human beings simply in general are not prone to consistency.
Yeah. Well, I would definitely
exceptions.
I would definitely affirm, even though this is a helpful way of engaging people, there's no rule that says only people who don't believe in God are called on the carpet for being consistent. So it's not meant to say it's a one-sided thing.
Well, this is a complaint I've had with some of Francis Schaeffer's writings for years. So anyway.
It's hard to say some of those things with your own personal politics.
He's not one of my favorite Christian philosophers.
Yeah.
But at any rate, looking at the idea of trying to stretch something to its point of absurdity, or being able to point out inconsistencies, if X is true, then what about Y? And if X and Y are both true, then how do we deal with sometimes I think are very heavy laden kinds of circumstances, which then you need to chase down in context of some kind.
Yeah. I would make a general remark too, just to be clear. This is not meant to be as long as I can poke enough holes in your view, you'll want something different. And I'll offer you my product. You know, it's not, I don't want it to make it sound as simple as that, because that would just be, what I want to do is, in the biggest picture, really, the overall paradigm for me is, there's, you know, 1 through 100 plus worldviews, and at the end of the day, if we sit down and run through all of them rationally, the one that comes out on top, by far, in my opinion, is Christianity. It makes sense of reality. Now, any worldview, including Christianity, is going to have difficult things to address and potential obstacles within the worldview and its philosophy. But what I hope to show through these little interactions and little tiny bites and pieces is that whenever these other things pop up, these other worldviews, the best alternative always turns out to be Christianity, and let me tell you why, kind of thing. So say, for instance, backing up a moment where I presented moral relativism, and I said, I said that there's this sort of motive, I think, or this ethic behind relativism that's sort of like respect for other people's beliefs. There's this sort of being willing to tolerate other people, I think, is part of the genesis of where we end up with that view. But that's not the only way of accomplishing it, right? There are other ways of explaining how we are to accept other people and respect in a tolerating sort of way other people's views, morally speaking. But you don't have to go as far as turning that into a dogma of what's right for you is actually right, and what's right for me is actually right, resulting in some sort of problem. Where I can just simply bring you to that point of tension, and then I can say, why do we need to go there when this is on the table and it's a better, coherent explanation? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was thinking that perhaps the rule or the law of universality is being able to say, is this really then the way that you want everybody to act?
Yeah.
And if in my own circumstances I choose to do X, do I really want everyone in similar circumstances to also choose to do X?
Sure.
And so the universalizability hallmark to some of us over what defines a ethically or morally acceptable response or position.
Well, we could follow a big rabbit trail there and talk about deontological ethics. But I'll avoid that. But that's actually a good, very easy way of thinking about it that could be used even if you're not a philosopher. right? Well, I would, people understand that it wouldn't work if everybody did it.
I suppose over the years I've had an occasion or two to where things like the principle of human responsibility can be used to show how absurd certain forms of behavior are as a way of getting down to reductive and absurdity.
Yeah.
Becomes absurd if everybody does. Everybody does that.
Yeah.
Is it all right to, you know, I think the last time I taught, the last few times that I taught ethics, which was a long time ago at Pacific University College, was adding to the course question, not just what do I affirm? What do I believe to be the case? And what would I live for? What would I die for? And then I tossed in the question, what would you kill for? And for some of us with a rather thorough strain of pacifism, then what would you kill for? What has Jesus, what has Yeshua asked us to kill other people for? And is there a divine mandate for killing anybody about anything? For example, pro-life people tend to also be pro-capital punishment and tend also not to be very well moved by the notion that the capital punishment might be improperly applied, something along that line, so it's this companion views.
Sure. Which, isn't that kind of a, I mean, you could almost say that's post hoc ergo prop ergo, couldn't you?
Yeah.
When you start talking correlation. Because something's associated with another thing, therefore it...
Well, that's a part of the causal. Just because something precedes something chronologically does not mean that it was caused by the first causes.
Right.
And so we're still looking at that in terms of looking for consistencies, particularly if our approach is built around trying to point out inconsistencies in other people's points of view.
Sure. Now, I had a conversation on campus yesterday about something akin to this, about, it was actually in a group setting when we were talking about what do you do when there are things that you haven't necessarily resolved. How are you supposed to minister to other people that have questions when you have your own questions, as it were, right? Like, if you're not resolved, how are you supposed to help other people be resolved? Something like that. And part of our sort of group conclusion was there's something human about that, and there's something sort of becoming about that. Now, I'm not saying we don't want to have a sufficient worldview that is the most coherent worldview. I'm not saying that. But insofar as we have questions, I think questions or internal sort of calling ourselves out on the carpet based on these sorts of things, I think there's room for that in our interaction because there's sort of a humanizing element to it where it's not the like sort of stereotypical, oh, you're the Christian that has all the answers and you know everything and you talk to God and you... your truth is with a capital T. That sort of pejorative view of what a Christian is.
I told you.
Yeah, so I think there's sort of a, that can actually be a virtue in some ways, as you're saying, to be true to this sort of inquiry within our own thinking. I think that helps us not seem like hypocrites, not seem like we're immune to this sort of thing. Like, we've arrived, and now it's time to make you arrive. Well, we're just asking them to to join in the process that we're all in as disciples of Christ. Okay.
Says Jean Roller.
Okay, I'll come to that in a second. Now, you know what I think we can do here, just before we take a brief break, is back up here and look at those. I'm going to pull out an example here.
What is this book that you gave me?
This is Tactics by Greg Koppel. Yeah, he has a ministry called Stand to Reason, and he has a radio show as well, or actually I think it's just a podcast now, or both probably. Okay, now, I'm just going to throw out an example and maybe we can talk through it. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk about Mother Teresa, so this is no disrespect to her and her lifelong mission, but it's just a good example. So, there was a double murder, Robert Alton Harris, and Mother Teresa publicly said, or not, I'm not sure if it was public, but she appealed to the governor of California to stay the execution, citing something like this: Jesus would forgive. That was her, the virtue, right? And Jesus would forgive, so I'm asking you to stay the execution. Now, what I'm not getting into, I'm not trying to say is therefore capital punishment is okay. That can be an open question. I'm not saying yes or no on that. I'm pointing out the logic of the statement, the internal logic. So, Mother Teresa says, this is the claim. If Jesus would forgive capital criminals, then it is wrong to execute them. Now, think through that. If you take the roof off that view and toy around inside the inner workings of that logic, what else would be true if that was the case? If that logic stands, what else is the case? Extend that logic outward. What do we get?
She's rationalizing that it's okay that homicide is okay because it's going to be forgiven anyway. Or am I?
Well, I think that's something different.
Yeah.
But in other words, this is almost like a version of the universalizing question, right? If you take what she says and you universalize it, what happens? If Jesus would forgive, therefore no, don't commit capital punishment, then anytime there is a question of capital punishment, we would say it would be wrong for government to punish any criminals, because one would always say, I guess not just capital punishment, but anytime you could extend that to any case where there's a criminal activity, and then there's a punishment. You would say,
does forgiveness imply removal of all forms, any form of punishment?
Right. That's an added layer to it, right there. So there's two layers we just mentioned. One is that if your logic holds, then it also holds that because if Jesus would forgive applies to this case, then why wouldn't it apply to every case of wrongdoing? And then the added element of...
There have been those who have said things like, was this particular the case that Mother Teresa was referencing? Has he brought forth some kind of fruit worthy of repentance? That is, does Jesus forgive the unrepentant? Mm-hmm. And so some would look at it and say, no. So we are to operate obligation to forgive the repentant. But is repentance sufficient to do away with any consequences or punishment? And under what other kinds of circumstances?
Right. I think it's also selective. I can add one more element in here. It's sort of selective thinking because there are different themes in Scripture and you have to weigh them against each other, right? So there's forgiveness, but there's also justice and punishment. And there's it's scriptural that the government is given power to punish evil doers. Now, what we do with that, and you know, you can have a question about capital punishment, but the point being is her argument proved too much, right? So I'm just trying to use an example there. So go one more. This one. You know, this book was written right here. There's a reason I'm thinking about it. 2009. And even though that was 2009 and it's 2016, this case study is even more significant now than when it was written 7 years ago. Okay, so here's a plan, and we're going to break it down. Here's the basic argument. Because people were wrong in the past, take a statement like this. I don't think same-sex unions should be endorsed by the government, basically because they did the same thing with interracial marriages in the past. They were wrong then, and now we're wrong about what we're doing with same-sex marriage. Okay, so somebody's proposed, I mean, there's a basic claim there. What's the logic of that basic claim? I mean, if you were to boil that down. People were wrong in the past on one issue. Therefore, they're wrong on a present issue that's similar. That's the basic argument, right? That's what they're promoting. So, if that was true, let me read it through to you this way. He has a sample dialogue here. So the first person says, I don't think same-sex unions should be endorsed by the government. And then the next person says, you know, people said the very same thing about interracial marriages. They were wrong then, and you're wrong now. Same-sex marriage is right. Next person. So you think the government should approve of homosexual unions? Person says, of course. And then the other person says, but people said the government should approve slavery too. They were wrong then, and you are wrong now. Same-sex marriage is wrong. So here's the breakdown. The argument was, because people were wrong in the past on one issue, they're wrong in the present on a different issue. So here's how we're taking the rebuttal. Since the government was wrong endorsing slavery in the past, it would be wrong for them to endorse same-sex marriage in the present. But this is absurd because the same kind of reasoning produces contradictory results. Same-sex marriage is wrong and same-sex marriage is right. By the same logic, you end up with a contradiction. So then you could say, therefore, it's not sound to argue that just because people were wrong in the past about interracial marriage, they were not wrong about same-sex marriage. Okay, well, I'll just leave that one at that. And talk more about that later if you want. Let's take a 5 minute break so I can get a drink of water and then we'll do one more. Okay, well, let's jump back in and I want to do one more tactic that won't take too long and then whatever time we have, we'll just role play and I'll give an official ending if we want to continue talking, we can. We can just camp here all night. Okay, so the steamroller tactic is not so much a rule of logic that we're dealing with, but sort of a how to deal with a certain sort of situation or a certain kind of person. So I don't know if you remember that these old, it was like an old cartoon and book series, like Mr. Happy, Mr. Sad, it had all the different emotions, and this is Mr. Rude. So the idea of a steamroller is we've all engaged a person at some point, whether it's about religion or anything, that somebody that's aggressive and they have a real larger than life personality and they constantly interrupt, like you're trying to make a point, and before you're able to finish your basic point, they're already nitpicking one element of your point. So you can't even have a dialogue because they constantly are trying to find something wrong in the minutia of what you're saying. And sometimes this is sometimes it's a non-rational issue. So let me talk about that for a second. It's a constant reminder, I have to remind myself that yes, there's going to be a lot of good discussion and interaction you can have with people on rational issues, but you can never ignore this person has a history. They've interacted with church probably in some form. It could be positive or negative. They may have been hurt by a Christian. They may, there's any number of things that could be factors that are non-rational factors. So some of those could be an emotional reaction. I can't count how many times I've interacted with somebody and after a little bit of casual talking, it comes out that they had, like, I don't go to church anymore because I had a bad experience when I was a kid or this or that. That's a constant issue. It could just be that they have a prejudice against Christians or Christianity in general. In other words, they've sort of already made up their mind before you are even talking about the content. Like, if I've already decided that before you even mention anything to me, then I'm not going to really take seriously what you're saying. I'm probably just going to push back, because I'm not even really entertaining what you're saying. I've already decided. And then three, it could just be a bad attitude. That's why I have Mr. Rude up there, because some people just don't have manners. So, and we're all guilty of flying off the handle or losing our cool ourselves. So this person just does that all the time. Now, the question is, what do you do in this situation? I mean, we're trying to be an ambassador here, diplomatic, and ask questions and be gracious. And this person is interrupting and they're aggressive. Well, the first thing is, a general rule of thumb is be calm. Don't let it get under your skin, right? We want to be winsome and we want to be gracious. So if we do back in kind, then we're not helping the situation. So this first step is to stop them. Really what this is a genial request for courtesy. It's just common courtesy that you're having a discussion or a dialogue. If they're going to constantly interrupt, then it's just going to be them interrupting you the whole time. It's not really a conversation. So you can just negotiate an informal agreement. Like, how about, I know you have ideas, but how about if you let me finish my thought and then I'll turn the floor over to you and you can finish your thought. I mean, that's basic courtesy, right? So you have to ask for that. So let's say you do that and then it doesn't work. Well, the next step is to shame the person. Now, I don't mean to start calling them names or point out, hey, look at this guy. It's no good. But you're sort of doing that in a gracious, you actually are doing that, but sort of in a gracious sort of way. You're saying, hey, this isn't working. Because you're still interrupting. if we could do it the way we said, you know, we could have a good conversation here. So could you do that? Basically, you're calling them on the carpet. And it's, if you've already agreed to something, then you're kind of being shamed because you're not abiding by what you agreed to. And then, and you know, this is sort of a step where it's like, you're basically starting out small, and then if they're really strong-willed, you're sort of matching that strength, right, by saying, okay, if you're going to be like that, then I sort of have to meet that with the same strength and say, okay, you got to play by the rules or this isn't going to work, is basically what you're saying. And then, again, if that doesn't work, the last step is leave them. This is the idea of not everybody deserves. If somebody can't be approached, then they don't necessarily deserve an answer or an engagement. And there's one exception that we could add on here, is, I don't know if you've been part of a discussion like this, but let's say you start talking to a person and there's two friends there, or there's several people start listening to this interesting conversation. There may be a moment where you say, normally, I would disengage this because this person is a little heavy-handed, but if there are other people in the mix, that may be an actual audience rather than another person. If that's the case, you may be actually more inclined to go ahead and go for it a little bit for the sake of the other ears. That's sort of a real-life example of what happens on social media. There are times where you could be in an online discussion, and you may realize at some point that this person isn't going to be swayed, but you go ahead and rehearse the dialogue because you know there are 100 other people reading this dialogue. But there are, even then, there comes a point at which, if they're just too belligerent, you just can't get anywhere with it. That's the point at which I hesitate to use the verse because it call somebody a dog, but you know, or a swine, but casting your pearls before a swine kind of concept here.
Isn't sometimes filibustering referred to as steamroller? That is, you just get up and you talk, and you don't give the other person a chance.
Right.
To
yeah,
say
it's filibustering.
It's not that, not even so much that you're interrupting, you don't give them a chance to say anything.
Yeah. Right. I think that's the case. I also wanted to say, because, you know, a lot of social media is so different now than, I mean, if you were to write this same book, it would work in the past, in a time before social media. But I think it's especially apropos because when you're in a chat or something or a dialogue online, I think this shame tactic works really well. From practical experience, when I call people out on the carpet, it changes the tone dramatically. There's this whole effect online where people just feel this liberty to act in a way that they would never act in person. Maybe some of them are actually sort of jerks. But even myself, I feel this temptation to say things in a way that I would never say in face-to-face. I've tried to temper that down, you know, like, what if this person was in front of me, how would I say this? I want to use that same graciousness online. But when you engage that person and they're in that mode where they're like, I can say whatever I want, this is online, you know, it's not even real life kind of attitude. And I make a cogent point, I make it carefully and graciously, and they come back with this vitriol. I immediately say, listen, I think I made a fair point here that's worth interacting with, but if you're just going to call names, then we can't really have a discussion. Do you think you could just politely interact if you were interested in interacting? Think about all the other people looking at that and watching that. And that person's thinking, oh, well, they either bail because they do just want to filibuster or just throw things at you. Or they settle down. So I think that's really effective. Okay, so that's steamroller, and I'll save the other one for next time. But let's go back to our bumper stickers. So we've added a couple concepts here to our tool belt. And I think we have time to do a little more of what we did last time. I thought that was kind of beneficial, just picking a bumper sticker. And these bumper stickers, in some ways, you know, that first step of taking the roof off was identify the basic argument. Well, the convenience of a bumper sticker is it's already a basic argument. if somebody was to say a whole paragraph, you'd have to, like, parse out the bumper sticker version of what they just said. In this case, we've already done that step to a large extent. Although, remember, when we did No God, No Morals in the Future, there was a question of, are you just throwing out three concepts? Are these in order? You know, there's still the question of what do you mean by that? Because there's a number of things that could mean. In fact, that could be true of a lot of these. So, which one interests you? I know you mentioned the Lenin one before.
Where's the one under intolerance say?
Well, that's the shirt that says, intolerance is a beautiful idea. So I put that in there because I thought it was a cool shirt. That would kind of be in reverse, though. You'd be drawing somebody's response rather than looking to ask them about the view that they're saying. You'd be inviting them to interact with your view. So that'd be a little different. But, I mean, we've got evolution up there. We've got pluralism. We've got
well, the religion one, because thinking is hard, because the argument would be, well, gee, people are religious because everything's already laid out for them. They don't have to think things through, and they'll just adopt this belief system that might make sense to them, and well, they let it define their identity.
Well, before you get too far, all of us, okay, so I have a bumper sticker, right?
Yeah.
So the point we started last time is I say, I how do you like my cool new bumper sticker? And then, I mean, see, you're already thinking through what it means, right? And yeah, to some extent it portrays something, otherwise they wouldn't have it out there, but you want to be sure you're interacting with what they think, because they have, there's a reason they put it up, because they think something. So you want to identify what that is so you can interact with that, rather than, I mean, what you're saying may be true, but what if you have like 15 other details and they don't have any of those details?
Yep.
You don't want to project that.
So
you want to ask
what
them.
I need to know is, you know, what interests you in putting that up, and what does that mean to you? Or,
yeah, something like that. So, well, basically, I put it up because religious people are just kind of like sheep. They just, they're not very smart, so they just kind of get suckered in by these superstitious beliefs.
Well, that means you've done some thinking, but I was under the impression that you were one of them because you seemed so Christian.
No, I'm not Christian. What would make you think I'm Christian? I'm role playing, so I'm the guy that's not a Christian, reacting to what you just said.
Oh, well, you look like one of them.
Okay. Well, you gotta imagine I'm like wearing a, you know, a grubby t-shirt. No, I try to stay as far away from those Christians. I don't really agree with anything they have to say.
So then that really is a cynicism on your part, that you're putting that up because it's a joke, that religion is more of a joke, because...
Yeah, exactly. As I said, people are sheep, and people that actually... Well, here, I'll respond again to your initial question. Well, people that actually use their brains aren't religious, because they realize that, you know, we've moved past superstition and myth and all that. So where can you take it from there? I mean, because you're going to have to, if you're going to try to narrow it down to one thing you want to pick on.
Well, then how much thinking have you done that, it's all the thinking that you supposedly may have done, have you arrived at any conclusion with some of your trying to unravel what might be truth?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm still thinking about it, but what I do know is that religion isn't the answer. I mean, why would anybody believe those fairy tales?
Well, what gives you the idea that religion's a fairy tale?
Well, you got, like, people raising from the dead, you've got all these different gods and these different religions. I mean, it sounds like a fiction.
It's your turn.
I mean, all we're trying to do is just, like, leave them with one idea that's a take. Well, you don't necessarily have to. I mean, the initial conversation could just be fact-finding. But eventually, you're just trying to leave them with one takeaway where their mind is left with something to chew on that they didn't have already, right? So obviously, I'm modeling kind of a pretty stark ignorance of certain things.
Well, in general, religion gives a paradigm so that it directs what thinking gets done. The emphasis usually, I think, in many people's minds about the nature of religion is acceptance, not analysis and proof. As you accept, so you don't have to think about it. That's your answer.
So you're letting me off the hook?
Well,
I mean, that may very well be true, but you're not leaving me with anything that's going to move my mind in a different direction at all.
Okay, I'm going to tell you what may seem a fairy tale to you may be it's being proven as factual. For example, nearly every culture that's known to the world has had some record of that there was a major flood in history. So this idea of Noah's Ark is not really a fairy tale children's story, that there was a huge calamity that happened. There was a flood, whether it was local or universal, that there's more and more proof that such a thing really existed. And if you think, like, for example, the story of Jonah and the whale, that the whale swallowed Jonah, and he lived in the belly for 3 days, well, they've proven there's an oxygen pocket in the stomach of a whale that a human being could survive in that stomach for 3 days.
Now, as Chris, I may agree with those things, but as the person with the bumper sticker, what you've just done is you've just given me two things to try and destroy. You've just erected two towers for me to attack. Rather than help me think through my own system.
Okay,
what you've
done
is offered me an alternative already that I've already said I think is superstitious.
Okay, Tim, what would it be, okay, if you were me, if you were the alternate,
So you said, what do you mean by that? Why would you say religion? Because it's hard, and I came back with, well, you know, people that actually have brains aren't religious because they know that's myth and fairy tale and all that weird stuff. So I might do more investigation. I might say, oh, well, which, have you looked at a lot of religions, or, you know, what have you read some of the holy books? How is it that you've come about what you know about religion? Like something along those lines. And I might say, well, already, see, now thinking about that as the person, the character, I'm already thinking, at least subconsciously, well, I haven't really investigated it. So I might say, well, I've read a little here and there, but my attitude is more like, isn't it obvious? Like, I don't really have to read it all to know that 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 there isn't a guy with a white beard sitting on a cloud somewhere. So I'm going to probably start exhibiting misunderstandings of religion and God. So I might say, yeah, I read some, but I don't really mean to. I mean, how much does it take to realize that that's just kind of stupid? And I'll probably continue just having this pejorative attitude. So I guess the goal from the other end, as I'm thinking through this scenario, would be I'm trying to move you to probably entertain God in general as a philosophical possibility, and also entertain Christianity as a historical thing, rather than just a fairy tale religious religion like any other religion. So those are two cardinal things that are crucial that I would try to slowly move towards just through exposing the way. So as I'm this other character, I'm saying, well, yeah, I haven't read that much, I guess, but you know, there's only so much you have to read to know it's ridiculous. And I say, well, have you read the New Testament? I know you sort of have this belief, but have you read some of the words of Jesus or the history of who he was? And then that'll bring out other questions like, or other responses like, well, no, but it could be anything. I don't know the Bible, or well, he's just like the rest. You know, and so you're just anticipating some of these responses and then coming back with, again, leading questions. You're leading them in a direction. So in some ways it's easier, right? Because, like I said, you're not erecting anything that they are trying to tear down. You're just interacting with their own worldview, their own slogan, their own thing that they're putting out for the whole world to see about themselves. Yet on the other hand, there is the difficulty, I think, is there's a million and one things to anticipate. But it just comes with time and study and interaction. So let's step back into it for a second. I mean, I've sort of provided like a gauntlet there of where we're headed. So let me step back into the role playing. You pick it up from where I sort of left it. So I just said, well, I haven't really read that much, but I mean, you really need to. I mean,
have you ever looked up religion in the dictionary? How would you define it?
Oh yeah, I don't know if I've looked it up, but I mean, it's basically people that do all sorts of weird rituals and stuff to try and live forever or something.
Well, it seems to me that religion comes about because people are searching for some higher truth or meaning to their existence, or people are searching for God, per se. That's why there is religion, because they try to come up with a formulary by which they may uncover what God is.
Okay, time out. You're pointing to a very important thing, right? There's this universal experience that you're pointing to. But what you got to do is get me to see how I think that myself by asking me a question.
Okay.
So you're trying to get me to that affirm what you're saying,
yeah.
But in a way that you're not erecting something for me to. Because you're shifting it when you do that.
Okay.
And then I'm like on your case.
Okay, so I would have to ask you, have you ever been in a situation in your life, in religious people seeking God, where you actually cried out to God because you were in a crisis? Have you ever done that personally, that you've felt a need for something more than yourself because of something bad that might have happened to you or a loss you had?
How would I respond to that? I would say, I'm trying to think through the character. I don't know how I'd respond to that. I guess I'd say, I mean, I've had my share of difficulties and hard things that, you know, that are hard, everybody does, but why would I, what good is it to cry out to, like, a fictional character? You know, I mean, what's the point?
Well,
now, just a little feedback.
Yeah.
I think that could possibly work, but I might be more reserved in how far I'm trying to take it, right? Because you're already trying to get them to express something they do that's sort of theistic or religious. So I might do that in two stages. I might first, somewhere in between here and there, I might get them to just try to identify the general human experience of either longing or need or the sort of idea that humanity collectively knows it has a problem and is trying to solve that. And there are a number of ways of getting at that, whether it's Jesus or humanism or whatever. So I might have that as a middle step, because we went kind of far from me thinking it's ridiculous and superstitious and mythical characters, and then you're asking me if I ever cried out to those mythical characters. But if you have that step in between, you can get there. I'm sorry.
What if we were to simply ask whether or not your bumper sticker is pro-religion or anti-religion?
Yeah, that's a good starting point. Or you could almost, like, if you perceived that they were anti, but you wanted to just, you could almost do it kind of humorously or satirically and say, oh, so you believe in God because you think it's a good idea, or something like that. Because you could take it that way, right? Or you could say, or something like, oh yeah, everything's so complicated, it's easier to just believe in God, isn't it? Almost tongue-in-cheek. I mean, you could do that. But yeah, so if you asked, so ask the question again the way you phrased it.
Is your bumper sticker pro or anti-religion?
It's anti-religion, yeah. I mean, I think religion is crazy. So what would your follow-up question be? Well, what if I said you're not a Christian, are you?
The response, if this is an anti-religion statement, which religions have you talked about?
Oh, yeah, good, yeah, see, that's perfect, because then we're getting down to the nitty-gritty of what exactly do you have a problem with that? Yeah, so I would say, well, just the same as you, probably. I've always got Mormons coming to my door, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Christians preaching anti-gay slogans. Those Westboro Baptist guys. And I don't know what else, but yeah, I've seen all those. They're all pretty much the same.
Have you ever wished that there could be a God, even if you don't think it's real? Have you ever wished it was real?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I don't know if I'd say it that way. I mean, maybe I see how it could be. I'm shifting my character a little bit, but I guess I could understand why somebody would want there to be a God, but I just don't think it's true. I mean, I understand that, you know, maybe it makes you feel good that there's, you know, that you have a sky daddy.
What's the most important thing in your life?
The most important thing in my life? I don't know, probably my family. And probably, like, hockey.
If you follow up in a totally different kind of way,
In a what?
Until it can come to play.
Okay.
Then whatever is your ultimate concern is your religion. That's how he defines religion. Mm-hmm.
That's what you would choose. That's how you spend your time following. Yeah.
So
that's brilliant. Yeah,
what is it that you invest your time in? What is it that you think about?
Right. So if you follow that route, you do the asking, and then maybe at some point, if you did the like, well, what do you think religion is, or what's your understanding of religion? They say something that maybe falls short a little bit. You might throw in a little bit. Well, I happen to have thought about that, or looked it up a little bit, and a good definition is blah blah blah. And then ask. I mean, there could be steps in between, but at some point, you might say, do you see how there's really not a lot of difference practically between that definition and the things that we call it.
So some would think, for example, that Tillich's a little wrong-headed in assuming that everyone has something that is most important to them. That there is something that ultimately concerns them. Whether it's family, what is it about your family that concerns you? And why is that a point of concern? In terms of, for example, the pressure of providing, what kids get.
Are you saying you might be wrong because some people just literally don't have an overriding concern?
Yeah.
Or because they... or in the more epistemologically, like they can't identify what it is.
Well, it's probably as much an epistemological question that is, what do I know, and how do I know it, why is it something that concerns me? But I've dealt in many congregations with an awful lot of people whose real ultimate concern was their family and not God and not. The loss or whatever. I mean, which is a very interesting kind of set of concerns, which are actually counterproductive.
Sure.
Jesus did say that father and your mother and all of these family people are not as important as he is. I mean, that's a direct part of the teaching.
Yeah.
So it's still in terms of how then does one understand religion? And if you understand it as an expression of ultimate concern,
yeah,
then having religion does not free you from having to think.
Sure, that's very good. And
religion does not free you from what?
Having to think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, religion is not a substitute for thinking.
Essentially what it does is it sort of blasts out a lot of this sort of false dichotomy. Like, there's people who aren't religious that think and really understand things, and then people who are religious who don't do the same. But you sort of throw everybody in the same things. But I need to time out just because of time. We can keep talking, but just for the sake of the recording, we are officially done.